On Point, hosted by Peter Van Aartrijk. Conversations with interesting and informative experts on technology, branding, culture, social media marketing, and other great topics.
Hello again, everybody. I'm Peter Van Aartrijk, your host for On Point, brought to you by our good friends at Wells Media, which includes Carrier Management, Insurance Journal, and other fine publications. Our guest today is Rob Looney, who is Chief Financial Officer of Westfield. Welcome, Rob.
Thanks, Peter. Glad to be here.
Yeah, thanks for joining. And you're actually, I believe this is a true statement, that you're the first CFO we've had on the podcast, which has been running continuously since 2009. So the stakes are kind of high for you.
or the bar could be seen as kind of low.
So yeah. But, you know, since you're originally from New York and now in my home state of Jersey, I think all will be good.
I think that's right.
So, Rob, tell us how this all came to be where you're at Westfield. Tell us about your background, how you got into finance and then insurance, and what first attracted you to this field. A lot of people say they fell into it. Maybe you have a different story there or not. But and then, you know, were there things that moments in your career, you know, that could be pivotal moments or mentors that that helped shape this whole trajectory that you've been on?
Yeah. Well, I think, yes, when it comes to insurance, that is a very common refrain. People get into the business by accident. That I've heard that plenty. I'd say maybe a little bit of that for me, but also maybe a little destiny. My mom ran a personal lines company on Long Island where I grew up. And so I kind of had an idea about how an insurance company ran and, you know, the impact it could have for customers and the community, et cetera. But that actually wasn't what drew me into insurance. And the next step also, I basically interned at my dad's bank and decided I wanted to get into banking. And when I helped his bank go public, when I was attending Villanova, I had the bug to get into investment banking. When I graduated, it was not a good climate for Wall Street jobs. So I decided to take my accounting major to PwC, where I really enjoyed my career there. And because I knew of the word insurance, I think they put me on Gen Re, which was one of their larger, you know, global reinsurance clients. And so that got me really started into the path of property casualty insurance and reinsurance. And from there, I was on the AIG audit. And there was really no turning back. So I've been in the insurance property casualty industry for 30 plus years. With respect to finance, though, it's a little different. So that, you know, that was more an accounting auditing start to my career. I went to business school and really got the bug for finance to see, you know, how basically, you know, accounting or finance people could be much more strategic. You take that with my earlier love of Wall Street, and I finally left public accounting and went into a career in investment banking for about a dozen years. So that was, but also focusing on insurance. So that was where I blended both of those things. And then after that, I had leadership roles in insurance and reinsurance companies. And so all of that is what really got me here today.
Did you say your mom ran a personal lines company, like an insurance company?
Yeah, she did. It was a small company called Statewide Insurance.
Wow.
There's a whole, for another podcast, there's a great story about how my mother worked her way up from a typist to the president of the company over a long period of time. But we'll save it for another day.
That's really cool. I love stories like that. So your mom was an insurance, I didn't even know Long Island had an insurance company. I know they have a lot of agencies and they have some good Italian restaurants.
Yeah, right. But no, it's a small, mostly auto insurance company. They took risks in, you know, Queens and Brooklyn and Nassau and Suffolk County.
Okay. Yeah. And your dad was a banker.
Yes. Yes, he was.
Okay. So it was meant to be.
Yes, to be in financial services. That's right. I learned more about office politics at the dinner table than I think most people do in their early internships.
Yeah. So how did you get to Westfield? What? How long have you been there? How'd you get there?
So I've been at Westfield a little over 3 years. Originally started when they were looking for a CFO of their new specialty startup business. And I knew Jack Kuhn a long time from my Axis days, and he gave me a call, and it seemed like a really great opportunity, and I jumped on it. And from there, I was privileged enough to get promoted to the enterprise CFO about 15 months ago. And so I have, which is really key for this job. I mean, it was a new business. Specialty is almost 40%, 50% of the company at this point. So I think that's a real advantage. But now I'm learning a lot more about the standard lines business and, you know, sort of the other parts of Westfield that make it tick.
Okay. So can you walk us through how Westfield has evolved from basically a few years ago? Historically speaking, not that long ago, a sizable but still a super regional PNC company writing standard lines based in Ohio. There's a ton of companies out in those states that kind of do the same thing. I know Westfield had some secret sauce in what they did. But this transformation it's been going through since I think 2020 or 2021 is pretty astonishing, at least for this guy. I've been bouncing around the industry for a few decades. It feels kind of like this 175-year-old startup now, you know, like where it's more like a faster moving public company even, and it's a mutual insurer. But how did this all happen, and what role are you, because you're an insider there now, what role are you playing in all this?
Yeah, so it is a pretty amazing story. I mean, we're moved on from 175, I believe we're at 178 years old now. And we are anything but a sleepy mutual company. You know, actually, and we could talk about the strategy now, but I would say that the company in its entire history has a longstanding history of taking, you know, calculated bets, you know, on some kind of diversification. So we've entered and exited several businesses in the financial services space, even in the life insurance space, and you know, technology investments. And I would say for the most part, they were mostly successful. You know, over a 178-year period, you're going to make a mistake or two. But the bets were small and calculated and worked out for us. I'd say what we're doing now with specialty is a much bigger, bolder bet. I think the confidence to do that came from the team that we attracted, of course, but also the timing was really fantastic for, particularly in the U.S. with E&S markets. We were in a really hard market, and we had a great opportunity because of the leadership of the specialty team to also buy a Lloyd's entity, where we were able to protect that transaction and really eliminate any kind of balance sheet risk. And so I would say that I wasn't here when we made the decision to do work on specialty, but it was great. I tip my hats to the leadership team at the time. It was bold, but I've been privileged enough to play a major role since I joined specialty, and I continue to play that role. And I think it's just about protecting our legacy, our balance sheet, making sure that we're not taking unnecessary risks. It's becoming more and more important to get insights and help people make decisions as the market conditions start to shift a little bit. So I get to have a front row seat to making sure that this bet that we took on specialty works out. And so far, so good. So we're really pleased with it.
Yeah. And how do you see, a lot of roles have changed, traditional C-suite roles, whether it's marketing or human resources, underwriting, actuary, and in the CFO world, they used to be the ones. This is going to sound terrible, but I always think of like an IT department, HR department, finance department. They were the people who like worked really hard, staring at their screens, and you know they stay in their office and you feed pizza under the door to them. You know, they just. they weren't really involved in any kind of true strategy. You know, it was a lot of things they did, but it wasn't really linked to anything. And that has evolved big time. How do you see your role in the whole finance world, and certainly in this business of insurance, which has got more complex? How do you balance all of this? How do you make it work? And where do you see the CFO role evolving in the near future?
First of all, they still work very, very hard. This I could attest to. But, you know, with Uber Eats and DoorDash, there are more choices than just pizza. But right. But yeah, I would say, and this has evolved over time, so this isn't really recent, but you know, finance did have the reputation for just keeping a ledger or watching maybe costs only, and then, you know, reporting what just happened in the past. And when I was in auditing, I used to tease, like, we're talking about last year. I can't wait to work at a company where we can talk about the current year. And actually, what we really require as a CFO is to be talking about next year or the year after. And so I think for me, I want to be a strategic partner. I've been a front office CFO for a lot of my career. My job is to help people make better decisions and faster. And I'd rather do that than explain the results after the fact. So, you know, we work closely with underwriting, claims, operations. We're not just in our own little silos anymore. You know, we provide clarity so that people understand the trade-offs. So I guess for me, the litmus test is, if leaders are calling finance before they make a big decision, not after, then we're doing our job.
Okay. So is it, can you talk a little bit about how you collaborate with your peers in underwriting and claims and operations and so on? It's not just your team that you're helping do jobs, their jobs better and faster. It's other departments, right? I mean, how do you keep it all together?
Yeah. I mean, I think in this case, finance is lucky. Like a insurance company finance people speak the same language as the underwriters, which is really helpful. You know, we talk about economics and finance. It's a much bigger advantage than if I was, let's say, a big auto company where there was an engineer running the company and we kind of have a mismatch in how we talk. Here, from the underwriters all the way up to the CEO, we're all speaking the same language. And I think that's a huge advantage. What I would say is, yeah, I'm working with them. I mean, the first thing I want to do is usually understand their business, listen, talk to them, let them know we're here, and, you know, try to provide insights. So we're in the middle of doing a finance modernization and to try to build better dashboards, you know, better systems, better reports, so they could make faster decisions. And so we are, you know, I think it's about trust and building relationships at first, and then it's coming through and following through and consistently giving them something that they could use.
Yeah. It seems like maybe the whole world's like this, but certainly in the insurance industry, it just seems overwhelming, the complexity, the way the world is, the way the world is all linked now. You know, back in the old days, you know, maybe you guys didn't have to worry about what was going on around the world because you were writing standard lines in the U.S. and in certain states in the U.S. And now you're all over the place. The specialty business is expanding. But there's all these risks out there. There's so many different, how do you, I mean, I made some notes here. There's the specialty world, there's alternative capital, there's reinsurance, there's climate risk, there's cyber risk, supply chain. I mean, I'm sure you got tons more in your brain. How do you deal with this? And we haven't even talked about artificial intelligence, the impact that could have on our industry. And then also preventing risks, preventing claims in the first place with predicting and preventing losses. It all involves money. I mean, that's why Warren Buffett got into the industry. It's just huge amounts of money that roll through insurance and out of insurance. And you're at the epicenter of this, Rob. Like, can you even sleep at night?
Well, I can sleep. I think it helped to work for a global reinsurer before I got here, because I got used to the fact that when I wake up in the morning, I read the newspaper about some kind of catastrophe, it probably affects our book.
Yeah.
You know, so I get the early warning indicators just from the news. But no, it is complex. And I don't think anyone has their arms fully around it. But at Westfield, I mean, we are coordinating with obviously risk and actuarial underwriting. We're trying to understand a lot of our risk, because we intelligently buy a lot of reinsurance to protect our balance sheet. I think what we worry about more than any individual risk is how things aggregate and how they sneak up on you, and how things correlate that we might have thought were more diversifying. You're always learning something about lines of business that you thought were completely diversifying to only find out that they're not as diversified as you think. So we try to do it through better systems, better reports, but also through conversation. I mean, you can't be, you know, talking to these people who are on the front lines, who are writing these risks, and also claims as a great partner. You know, sometimes when we get a lot of insights into our business through claims. So the feedback loop for claims to the underwriters and even to our reserving actuaries to make sure they could take care of our, you know, balance sheet. That's, I think, more critical than any report I can use. So it's really paying attention to what's going on in our business.
Yeah. Do you feel like you have a decent handle on what's going on with the cycles too? Hard, soft market, the catastrophe exposure, et cetera. Any insight there?
Yeah, I mean, we try to manage the cycles. That is the key here. I would say this, you know, there's always talk about whether we're in a hard cycle, soft cycle. We all know that the hard cycles don't last nearly as long as they used to, and the soft cycles seem to last forever. And that's really a factor of supply and competition, et cetera. But actually, each one of our businesses operates a little independently. You know, one business starts going, you know, having a lot more competition, is becoming soft. There's usually another business that's still enjoying really great rate, you know, rate adequate returns. And so we try to allocate our capital as best we can. We like to stay consistent, but we like to look at where we should be allocating capital. Maybe we de-emphasize certain lines of business. And I think what the underwriters do a great job is they're really careful about the lines they put out. We manage the limit sizes. And in our excess business, which obviously we go more volatile than our straight standard line businesses, you know, they attach at a pretty healthy level and manage limits. And so I think managing it, thinking about it, thinking like an owner, I think is really important when you're putting out capital and making these decisions. And, you know, we're not always going to get it right, but we're certainly going to make sure that, you know, we've had a discussion about it, and we have to be in a position to kind of flex very quickly if we need to.
Yeah. What about the investment returns for the industry in recent years?
Well, they've been really good, particularly this year. We had a really benign hurricane season for the U.S. I think, don't quote me, but I think there were no hurricanes that hit mainland U.S., which might be the first time in quite a while. And so while there have been other things that happened around the world, not really in our footprint. So that coupled with an incredible investment climate, I think the industry is enjoying a significant return, well into the double digits ROE, you know, that they look for. I think we try to manage as an industry double digit ROE, but we're into the teens now. And so, it's a really great year for insurance. And I just hope that we can be disciplined enough to, you know, to not give it all back in the next year or two, you know.
To be continued, that story, right?
Yeah.
Can you talk a little more about the value of that mutual organization component that's involved here? That's an additional dynamic, right? That you can take advantage of, right?
Yeah, I mean, I think of it this way. We have this discussion internally, and I hear it quite often. And I am lucky enough to have worked at publicly traded companies and mutual companies. And then as a banker, I was actually demutualizing some companies in the Midwest and taking them public. And so I can say this, I'm very happy and very proud to be at a mutual company, not just because of the legacy and what they also do for the community, but also, like, it helps to me. It's about time. We can make decisions with a longer term horizon than the pressures that some publicly traded companies feel managing quarter to quarter. And I think in our business that's complex, that requires a lot of thought, I think it's a huge advantage. We don't think that we should be less profitable than a property casualty company. We just think we could be more patient in getting there.
Yeah. You know, Rob, this is me talking now, but it just seems almost unfair that the quarterly results get reported by the stock insurance companies. It just seems like an unfair time horizon when you're dealing with some of these things are really longer tail. And I don't know, it just, again, I think it's an advantage if you have that horizon.
You spend, when you think about the amount of time you spend, because it's so complex, because it doesn't fit neatly into a quarter, when you think about maybe the distraction and the cost to the organization of telling that story, which is very important, right? If you're a shareholder, you want this transparency, you want this information. So I'm not saying it's wrong to report, but there is a lot of effort that goes into these quarterly reports and then, you know, calls and then meetings with, you know, analysts. And can you imagine if you took that out of the picture and just sort of focused on the real complex problems of the company? I think the industry would be better off, honestly.
Yeah, that's my read too. So, well, Rob, you touched on this a little bit earlier. How have you learned about leadership over the years? Maybe you learned it originally from your mom and dad, but because it's such an important component these days. There's at least four generations in the workforce, a lot of diversity in the workforce too, age, gender, et cetera. And you know, there was a time probably before COVID when people just went to work, was a place you went to, and now it's a thing we do. We're not always commuting. It's you know, it has evolved. People, the intertwining of their personal lives and work lives, it's really heavy for a manager, even a middle manager, let alone the C-suite. So how have you evolved? What things have stayed the same for you as you look back, and how have you evolved in terms of leadership?
Yeah, that's a great question. I actually think about leadership a lot, and I think it's core to what you need to do. I've had some great mentors over the years, particularly my days in PwC. There were some, you know, our property casualty practice in New York was, by the way, I'm old enough that the firm was called Coopers and Lybrand then before they
My
Waterhouse.
Oh, that's
so,
right.
But we had a terrific practice, and those partners and leaders, they either stayed and did great things there, or they moved on to some significant jobs in the industry. And I learned a lot during those years. I've had great mentors and coaches as well in all my other organizations, but I would say that was the foundation. And for me, what I learned there is clarity matters, right? So I think the people who work for me, I cannot possibly micromanage them. So what I need them to understand is what matters and how we make decisions, and teach them to make decisions and take some risks as long as they can back it with some kind of reasoning, or, you know, and don't be afraid to take risks with decisions. Certainly I'm going to be there to validate what they're doing. I'm certainly not going to ignore them, but you know, they have to learn, I think, and I try to instill the confidence for people to make some mistakes. I also try to hire people who are just better than me in their domains. That really helps me quite a bit. I give them room to operate, but I still hold them accountable, obviously. But you know, learning from the people who work for me too has been something that I've enjoyed. And there's always something I can teach them, even when they're smarter and better than me. And so I don't know, as I think about the leadership, the longer I'm doing this, I also think it's very important to make decisions with imperfect information and to stay calm under pressure. There's no advantage when someone reports to me. I always want to hear about bad news right away. And so the contract I have with my people is, I'm not going to beat you up. I'm not going to kill the messenger, but I need to know about this bad news right away. And so staying calm under pressure, I think, really makes a difference. And when they see that, I think it helps them to help think through the problems as well. So I think what I'm really supposed to be doing is creating the conditions for people to make good decisions. I don't have to be the smartest person in the room, but I think I can help orchestrate how we can collectively come to a really good decision, you know, and be calm under pressure.
Yeah, that's really good, because a lot of times when you get to the point of being in the C-suite, being the top dog, you feel like you have to have all the answers, you know, And I don't think anybody has all the answers.
Yeah. Never had that at all.
But you know, Rob, I'm not saying anyone at Westfield's like this, but I worked in New York City, I worked in Washington, D.C. I've seen a lot of people who are afraid to be, it's almost like there's a vulnerability when you say, I don't have all the answers, but they're afraid to show that. They're afraid to not have people say they got all the answers. And of course, it's all doomed to fail, but the ones who succeed are, to me, I've seen them be more like a servant leader in a way. They create the environment as you talked about there, where others can succeed. And then you succeed, you learn, like you said, from them, but also the whole organization does better. You know what I'm talking about. You worked in the city, so you know these people. They're there. They're very persuasive. They're very strong. They're very articulate. They can be bullies, et cetera. I like what you're saying. That's why it's kind of cool that you are at a company like Westfield, you know, born and raised in Ohio, that company where still there, of course, that's the heartbeat, but those are Midwestern values where you're talking about right there. I hate to tell you, it's pretty rare to come out of Long Island in New York City and have that kind of philosophy.
I know I'm pretty lucky that they let this East Coast boy into the West Club there. Well, I probably was destined to be associated with Midwest because one of my journeys as an investment banker was at KeyBank, which is based in Cleveland, Ohio. And so, I think our company is unique. And I've worked for people that you've described. And what I can tell you is you shut down with that kind of thing. You know, it's not a healthy environment, but if someone allows you to be a bit vulnerable or ask questions, by the way, chances are the person who you're asking those questions already thinks they're smarter than you anyway. So you're not like actually decreasing your own value by asking these questions. In fact, you're more likely to impress people that you're being thoughtful. And so I absolutely agree with you. You know, I think these Midwest values, though, extend way beyond the Midwest. I think I've been privileged enough to work at some great companies, including New York. And so they exist.
Yeah. I was at a dinner once in New York with a CEO and a bunch of other people. And he sit at the head of the table. And finally he says, you know, I'm tired of talking about me. Why don't you guys talk about me for a while? It was awesome.
I think I've learned to be a little bit more disciplined about not doing those things. I had a lot of experience working in Europe as well. And so I can tell you working in Zurich and in London and even to a certain extent in Bermuda, they're not really interested in the self-promotional kind of leader. You know, they want to get the business done and let's get on with it, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, maybe that's a uniquely American thing. I don't know. Uniquely. By the way, whatever happened to KeyBank?
Well, KeyBank's still around.
It is still around. Okay.
Very well. Yes.
Okay, good. All right. So just a couple quick questions more about you. As you think back to, working at the bank with your dad and other things you did early in your career, is there anything you would change along the way? Is there any advice you might give your younger self?
It's funny. In some ways, I think I followed my own advice I was fortunate enough to have, you know, so much of a head start with thinking about, you know, a business career, et cetera. But I had careers. We probably mentioned this more than once already. But in public accounting, in investment banking, I had leadership roles across insurance and reinsurance. And each stop, I learned something different. Some of them were more technical positions and some of them were more leadership type positions. And I think I attribute all of my success or most of my success now to those experiences. So I guess I would say to my younger self, you know, keep seeking out different experiences that stretch you. And even if they don't look like, I think the mistake a lot of people make when they're young is they think there's a direct path. I have to do A and then that comes to B, that goes to C. And I think that's not true. It might not look like the most direct path, but you could be accumulating a lot of skills and experiences along the way that all come together later in life. And I think that's what happened for me, actually.
That's cool. Yeah. I think My dad used to say, life is not linear, enjoy the curves.
Yeah, that's right.
And I think today there's so much fear and loathing among the younger folks about how AI is going to blow up their careers. And, I certainly think they'll be fine eventually. There could be a lot of disruption. And in fact, I read a piece about how, quote unquote, white collar, which is kind of a term that's a little demeaning, I think.
And blue collar. Get away from those kind of labels.
Yeah, but that's what the piece was about. Use those words, white collar, blue collar, how they're going to be blending in more people, the traditional roles in the office, for example, are going to have to learn other things. And that's putting pressure on four-year schools and everything. I just think work is going to change a lot. And in fact, it could be a rather exciting time if we can get rid of some of the stuff in our workday that's sort of frictional. I mean, the insurance industry is famous for being efficient at being inefficient. Now, you look at the workflows that agents or brokers have to go through to get to carriers and back down again. Everybody's fighting to make it cleaner. If AI changes that, what could we do with our time? We might spend more time with our associates. We might spend more time with our policyholders and helping them navigate risk in life. And I think there could be some cool outcomes, but right now I think you're right. There's going to be some twists and turns in careers, and the people will learn in different ways.
Yeah. I think, at Westfield, we're going through, so within my own domain, we're going through a pretty big finance modernization project. Mm-hmm. And there's an AI component to it, although I don't want to exaggerate. It's a small part at the time. But really, the goal of this is the same that AI is sort of bringing to us. I want to get out of the business of data prep and get into the business of data analysis. And so I think these tools will help us tremendously. But there's no doubt that some people will not make the adjustment or the transition from moving sort of numbers from one place to another, or, trying to debug like a report or insurance and have to actually sit there and try to interpret results. And more importantly, be effective at taking those results and trying to inform the business. So I think there will be a shift in the kind of employees that we employ, but I know that our company is very thoughtful about this, and we'll try our best to cross train or take chances on people. And I think that's all we really can do at this point. There's no turning back the progress, for sure.
Yeah, right. All right, Rob, what's your favorite restaurant where you live? You got to give me something good, because Jersey's all about great food.
This is the Jersey thing now, right? Well, I live in Summit, New Jersey, and I absolutely love a steakhouse called Roots.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, Roots, the service is outstanding. The vibe is great. And the food's always, always excellent. Early when I went there, I hope nobody from Roots is listening to this, but if the story turns out okay, I was thinking, I was like, I love this restaurant. I love the vibe, but I'm thinking, why are they charging me New York prices for, without New York rent? But guess what? I haven't said that quote in 25 years now, or 20 years. It's well worth it. So whatever they're charging,
I was in there one time, actually with a couple of clients who were insurance brokers, and we're sitting there at the table. And I'm a big hockey fan. Gary Bettman, the NHL commissioner, was sitting at the table next to us. It was a cool moment. But yeah, that's a good spot. Now, do you like Italian food, or is a good Italian there?
Fiorino is the best Italian restaurant in town as well.
Okay.
And their service is impeccable. So no doubt. I mean, Summit, we are blessed with quite a few nice restaurants.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a good part of the state for sure. That's the part of the state, like kind of the northwesty side that people often don't see, is along with the southeastern side, the beach, the Pine Barrens. And most people are going from Philly to New York City up the Turnpike, and they just see that part.
Yeah. And if all they had to do was basically turn left at Newark Airport and go another 10 miles, they'd hit Summit. It is a beautiful park. Look, it reminds me, I think I grew up in a nice part of Long Island as well, but I think Summit is just as nice with deer in the backyard, which is a special thing.
Yeah, that's really cool. Yeah. Well, Rob, thanks so much for taking time. I know you're busy. Have a good 2026. Hopefully the investment returns will continue and we'll have a Comcat year. I hope I didn't jinx that, but I'm sure you're on top of it.
Well, thanks, Peter. I really enjoyed this. So thanks a lot for including me in this podcast.
This has been On Point with Peter Van Aartrijk, a podcast presentation of Wells Media Group.